Monday, August 31st. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a shooting in the U.S. city of Portland, Oregon, after a weekend of clashes between protesters and a caravan of Trump supporters.
Your campaign of fear is as anti-democratic as anything you've done to create hate and vitriol in our beautiful country.
Democrats express outrage over a new policy to deny them intelligence on election security. Also ahead, an overwhelming collective grief over the death of a beloved Black American actor. It's all on today's International Edition. Ongoing nightly protests in Portland, Oregon intensified over the weekend as a pro-Trump caravan clashed with Black Lives Matter demonstrators. One person was shot and killed Saturday. President Trump tweeted in support of the group Great Patriots in all caps and shared a video of them coming into the city. That city has been dealing with months of demonstrations following the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler responded to President Trump's numerous tweets, which seemed to encourage the violence.
Mr. President, why, this is the first time in decades that America has seen this level of violence. It's you who have created the hate and the division. It's you who have not found a way to say the names of Black people killed by police officers, even as people in law enforcement have. And it's you who claimed that white supremacists are good people. Your campaign of fear is as anti-democratic as anything you've done to create hate and vitriol in our beautiful country.
Meanwhile, police issued a plea for any information related to the killing, including videos, photos, or eyewitness accounts. The shooting happened around 15 minutes after the caravan of about 600 vehicles that were part of a pro-Trump rally left downtown. There is a growing concern over groups of militias taking the law into their own hands in cities where there are protests over racial injustice. Joining us to talk more about it is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which has also seen its share of unrest following the police killing of George Floyd. Thank you for being with us. What do we know about these militias, like the one, the 17-year-old shooter in Wisconsin last week, who killed two protesters claimed to be involved in?
Right-wing militias are one of the most dangerous terrorist organizations and groups in the United States. There's a study that came out that actually said so from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. They looked back at everything from 1994 onward, and what they found was that the growth of right-wing militias is bigger, more intense, and more dramatic than any other group in the United States, including religious zealots. The fear that we're seeing right now is in places like Portland, in places like Kenosha. If we want to go way back, we can look at Charlottesville early in this president's term of office. And what we find is not only are they more active, they're more aggressive, but it also appears that they're actually being supported, at least from the bully pulpit, from the president himself. And that is particularly disturbing.
What do they believe they're charged to do?
That's part of the difficulty, because what we're seeing right now is a president who's actually creating this sort of good guy, bad guy, on the right side of the law, on the wrong side of the law. And he's describing these militias, these groups, as being allies of the police. The problem is in many ways, and places like Portland, the police have actually become allies with them. But if you consider what it is to be a person of color who's protesting, who's actually out doing what it is the First Amendment says they can do, and you see right-wing militias, hate groups, allying with the police themselves, doesn't that support the very contention of what they're arguing? And that's part of the problem. And now there's a face-off, and the police pull back, and they actually let the right-wing militia groups do what it is that they do. This isn't just rhetoric. In the last week, one of those right-wing groups in Portland called the Proud Boys actually came in, fought directly against protesters, and the police stood back and watched. I'm coming to you from Minneapolis, and what we're seeing right now is there were people in the streets just several days ago. And what we see is so much tension in the streets of this country, not Democratic streets, not Republican streets, but U.S. streets. It is a tinderbox.
The recent shooting in the back of a black man in Kenosha, Wisconsin, protests ensued. And then a few days later, a 17-year-old now charged with murder came with a rifle, with an assault rifle, and killed two people and severely wounded another. He's basically a part of these so-called militias as well. My question is, are all of these people in these militias, is this even legal?
One of the studies that has been conducted over the last few years has found that right-wing militia groups have infiltrated the police department themselves. And I think that's consistent with this concept of the police and some right-wing militias actually seeing themselves as allies. And that is exactly why some people are in the streets arguing exactly as they are. Look, this is one of the biggest problems facing the national security establishment right now. They're trying to figure out how to pivot from not just extremists from abroad, but what happens when you have extremists at home. This is all well and good until you realize that the biggest domestic threat in America is right-wing militia groups. And when they think that they're actually above the law, that means they can do whatever it is they think they want to do. The debate right now is, are there sufficient laws in place to address this? And think of it this way. If you have people walking in the streets armed, should you stop them? Should you address this? Is it illegal for a 17-year-old to be walking in the streets armed? The answer is no. The answer in Kenosha, Wisconsin is no, it's not.
So what about Portland now?
Well, in a case like Portland, it's the same situation. If you see people walking in this environment armed, is it appropriate for the police to stop and address the issue? And the answer is yes, but it has to be done consistently, and it has to be done for everybody, not just those people that they deem to be a threat, especially when people who might very well be white and look like right-wing militias are given a pass, and anybody who is of color is grabbed and wrestled to the ground. It really, again, highlights the reason that there are so many people in the streets. It's because institutional racism exists. We have seen it for centuries. It continues to this day. And all this does is to continue to support that very concept.
As we get closer and closer to the election, it seems these tensions are not quieting, but they're actually getting bigger. How concerned are you from a legal standpoint that this is going to continue spreading to other cities across the country and turn into something we've never seen?
I'm very concerned. If we think about the threats that we face collectively as a people, we realize that people of color have been facing this for 400 years. And some are simply saying, let's start with peace, and then we'll address this. My response is that people of color have been crushed under the wheel of quote unquote peace, waiting for something to happen. Do you feel that they're going to simply sit back now and say, oh, sure, I can wait another 400 years? That's the problem. If you think about a 17-year-old boy who is actually not allowed to carry a firearm, an AR-15, openly, as he did, and he wasn't stopped, that tells you about systemic racism, because they see him, the police see him, and they don't see a threat. Think about what that means when you're an African-American who gets stopped just for driving, not driving illegally, but just driving while black.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thank you so much. Well, the events in Portland followed a week of unrest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, amid fury over the police shooting of Jacob Blake in the back, which left the 29-year-old black man paralyzed. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports President Trump plans to go to Kenosha on Tuesday.
White House spokesman Judd Deere told reporters aboard Air Force One Saturday that President Trump will be meeting with law enforcement officers and surveying some of the damage from recent protests that turned destructive. Trump has been running his reelection campaign on a law and order mantle, denouncing protesters as thugs while voicing his support for police. Democratic opponent Joe Biden has accused President Trump of rooting for violence amid unrest in Wisconsin. I'm Shelley Antler.
Meanwhile, the UN Human Rights Office has condemned the shooting of African-American Jacob Blake and said the use of force by police may violate international law. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Riots broke out in the city of Kenosha in the U.S. state of Wisconsin in the wake of Sunday's police shooting of Jacob Blake, which has left the 29-year-old African-American man partially paralyzed. The U.N. Human Rights Office views the shooting as a painful reminder of the heightened risk African-Americans run when engaging with law enforcement in the United States. Agency spokesman Rupert Colville says the episode reaffirms the need for urgent action to eradicate links between structural racism and policing.
From the images available that we've seen at this point, the police appears to use force against Jacob Blake that would seem to be excessive, and it does not appear that the law enforcement officers abided by the international standard for the intentional use of lethal force with a firearm.
A statement from the Kenosha Police Union said that based on officers' inability to gain compliance and control from Blake after using verbal, physical, and less lethal means, the officers drew their firearms. Colville says it seems highly possible the force used against Blake could be discriminatory in nature. The human rights spokesman also says he is aghast at the presence of vigilantes at the protest in Kenosha. He says he finds the killing of two people and injury of others by a 17-year-old gunman of particular concern. The teen, who took a rifle to the protest of Blake's shooting, told an online news site before going to the demonstration that it was his job to protect people. First-degree reckless homicide, first-degree intentional homicide, and attempted first-degree intentional homicide are among the criminal charges the young man is now facing.
We would see this as, you know, yet another, unfortunately, example of the insufficient and lax gun control measures in the United States, which is something we've spoken about several times before. You know, it should be inconceivable that you have a 17-year-old running around with an automatic rifle in a position to shoot people in this way in such a tense situation.
Colville says the events of the past few days in Kenosha are not only recurrent, but preventable. He warns against sending federal troops into Kenosha to restore law and order. He says their presence is likely to make things worse rather than better. In a tweet Friday, U.S. President Donald Trump said that the National Guard had successfully quelled violence and rioting in Kenosha. He said, since the National Guard moved into Kenosha, Wisconsin 2 days ago, there has been no further violence, not even a small problem. When legally asked to help by local authorities, the federal government will act and quickly succeed, the president said. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of people took part in a march in Washington on Friday to denounce racism on the anniversary of the march in 1963, where civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. made his historic I Have a Dream speech. VOA's Jason Patinkin was there and files this report on the day's events.
People started lining up just after sunrise for their chance to take part in Friday's March on Washington in the United States Capitol. The event was full of emotions, anger, grief, resolve, and love, as thousands gathered from around the United States to protest against racism and police brutality. As the crowd sat and stood for hours in the heat, dozens of speakers took to the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in the heart of Washington, D.C., where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his legendary I Have a Dream speech in 1963. This time, the march was billed as a commitment march to rededicate Americans to King's message of racial and economic equality at a time when open racism, economic inequality, and political violence are at levels not seen for decades in the United States. The first speaker was Mimi Taylor, an organizer of Black Lives Matter in Washington, D.C.
We must invest for the police and invest in black communities in the black community. Because in D.C., Black Lives Matter means defund the police.
A main theme of the event, voting U.S. President Donald Trump out of office. Volunteers handed out face masks to everyone entering, printed with the words, I will vote, and registered people to vote on the spot. Rick Hart, a Morehouse College student and member of the National Action Network, which organized Friday's march, said that the United States was at a moment of reckoning.
And we surely mustn't forget that each and every day Donald Trump and his allies stand in the way of this movement by deliberately sowing injustice and inequity along the lines of racism, xenophobia, agoraphobia, and misogyny. But this upcoming election is about so much more than them. It is about electing progressive prosecutors who will fight to reform the criminal legal system. It is about electing legislators who will fight to pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act and the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act.
Martin Luther King III, the son of the late civil rights icon, was one of the keynote speakers.
But we must never forget the American nightmare of racist violence exemplified when Emmett Till was murdered on this day in 1955 and the criminal justice system failed to convict his killers. 65 years later, we still struggle for justice, demilitarizing the police, dismantling mass incarceration, and declaring and determinedly as we can that black lives matter.
Civil rights leader Reverend Al Sharpton directed part of his speech at President Trump.
We do not want to be disrespected. How do you speak while this young man, Jacob, lies in a hospital and you won't call his name? How do you sit while Breonna Taylor's in a grave and you won't call her name? How do you sit while Eric Garner's in a grave and you won't call his name? How do you sit while George Floyd is laying in a grave and you won't call his name? Well, Mr. Trump, look right down the block from the White House. We come to Washington by the thousands. We gonna call their name. We gonna call their name. We'll never let America forget what you done. Call their name.
Dozens of relatives of people killed by police also spoke to the crowd in the sweltering sun. Theonis Floyd, the brother of George Floyd, became emotional while he spoke.
I'm so overwhelmed right now with everybody here right now. I wish George would have seen this right now. That's what I'm marching for. I'm marching for George, for Breonna, for Ahmaud, for Jacob, for Pamela Turner, for Michael Brown, Trayvon, and anybody else who lost their lives.
There were so many families of people killed or wounded by police in attendance that there wasn't enough time for each to speak. After the speeches ended, the march continued across Washington, D.C. It was not the first, and surely not the last, protest for racial justice in America. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
Top Democrats say they may subpoena intelligence officials to testify on election security after the Director of National Intelligence stops in-person briefings. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Senator Amy Klobuchar says she's outraged at Intelligence Director John Ratcliffe's decision over what he calls leaks.
I think the House is going to have to subpoena the Director of Intelligence in order to get information, which is crazy.
She also tells ABC's This Week monitoring foreign interference should be paramount. President Trump was asked about it Saturday at a hurricane briefing in Texas and said Ratcliffe is right.
You have leakers on the committee, leakers that are doing bad things, probably not even legal to leak.
Trump did not offer details. Ratcliffe said lawmakers will get written updates. I'm Julie Walker.
Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. U.S. President Donald Trump's national security advisor said Sunday more Arab and Muslim countries were likely to follow the United Arab Emirates in normalizing relations with Israel. The White House official Robert O'Brien and Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner met Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem on Sunday ahead of today's talks in Abu Dhabi on finalizing formal Israel-UAE ties. Egyptian public prosecutors have ordered the detention of a second man suspected of being involved in an alleged gang rape at a luxury hotel in Cairo in 2014 pending investigations. Police arrested the man on August 28th, days after a first suspect was arrested in Cairo. And Russian President Vladimir Putin used a birthday wishes phone call Sunday to invite Belarusian leader Alexander Lukashenko to visit Moscow. A Kremlin show of support as thousands of protesters stream into central Minsk, demanding Lukashenko step down. He turned 66 on Sunday and continues struggling to contain 3 weeks of protests and strikes since winning an August election that his opponents say was rigged. U.S. cases of the novel coronavirus surpassed 6 million on Sunday as many states in the Midwest reported increasing infections. Global coronavirus cases surged past 25 million as well as India marked a worldwide record for daily new cases. Meanwhile, a coronavirus deal signed by Australia with an international drug company is raising ethical concerns among prominent church leaders. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Australia has signed a deal with the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca to produce and distribute a vaccine being developed by Britain's Oxford University, if the treatment works. But three of Australia's most senior archbishops have written to Prime Minister Scott Morrison, urging him to reconsider the agreement, saying the use of fetal tissue in the research is deeply immoral. Dr. Glenn Davis is the Anglican Archbishop of Sydney.
To use that tissue then for science is reprehensible. Once I know something, that it is morally compromised, then it is my job to speak out about it.
The Oxford University study uses embryonic kidney cells harvested from a female fetus in the Netherlands in 1973. Dr. Nick Coatsworth, Australia's Deputy Chief Medical Officer, says the work adheres to strict guidelines.
There are strong ethical regulations surrounding the use of any human cell, and this is a very professional, highly powered research unit.
Other vaccines in Australia use genetic material that originally came from a human fetus. They include inoculations against rubella, hepatitis A, and rabies. Senior religious leaders have not explicitly called for a boycott of the potential Oxford University COVID-19 drug. But they have said that members of their congregations might consider their individual conscience. Experts have stressed that any successful vaccine for coronavirus developed using fetal cells would have no remnants of that genetic material in the final product. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Oh. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London. Twitter at Border Crossings or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. The legendary Tour de France began Saturday, 2 months later than usual and a day after France recorded its sharpest single-day coronavirus caseload since late March. From Paris, Lisa Bryant reports for VOA on how the pandemic is shaping an unprecedented race.
Bonifacio.
The crowds usually packing the start of the Tour de France are absent this year. Just 100 spectators were allowed for the early afternoon kickoff at the Promenade des Anglais in Nice, where masks are now required for all outdoor spaces. That's just a taste of how the virus this year is upending the 3,500-kilometer race, which crosses the mountains, vineyards, and villages of France. Team riders will be tested regularly and wear masks when not competing. The big question is whether the Tour will end as planned 3 weeks from now at the Champs-Élysées in Paris or be forced to cut off early. There are other reasons why the world's greatest bike race is very different this year.
J'avais une vingtaine d'années, j'ai suivi une étape qui passait dans le Cantal.
69-year-old François Julliard, former head coach for the French track and field team, remembers following the Tour when he was young. The caravan came first, then the riders who made difficult climbs seem easy. He said it was pretty spectacular. That festive atmosphere with candy showered at kids and tens of thousands of fans lining the roads will be largely absent when the Tour passes Julliard's home in central France. National coronavirus measures limit crowds to no more than 5,000.
Ça va changer beaucoup parce que le Tour de France est au mois de septembre.
And with French back at work, Juillard says, the Tour will be a lot more virtual, experienced by many fans via TV, instead of in real life.
Les coureurs font des performances exceptionnelles, hors normes.
Eric Bouvat, longtime doctor for Tour Team AG2R La Mondiale, says it's unclear how that will affect the race. He says part of the exceptional mountain performances of Tour riders come from the stimulation from those cheering crowds. It's unclear whether they'll find other ways to compensate. So like many other things during this time of the coronavirus, the 107th Tour de France will break new ground, possibly marking the beginning and not the end of a new normal. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Basketball hero Kobe Bryant, civil rights icon Representative John Lewis, and now actor Chadwick Boseman, who starred in the blockbuster superhero Marvel film Black Panther. So far, 2020 has been marred with bad news and tragedy over the deaths of popular black icons in America who were viewed as leaders in their respective fields of sports, politics, and film, places where people, particularly in the black community, have often looked for inspiration during a year of racial tension and protests. But for many, the loss of another major figure such as Boseman is taking an especially painful toll. He died Friday at the age of 43 at his home in Los Angeles after privately battling colon cancer for 4 years. We leave you today with some music we're sure he would approve of from Friday's March on Washington on the anniversary of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr.'s iconic speech, I Have a Dream. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Bunganyi, I'm Lori London in Washington. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.